You're listening to Simpler, One Earth Living from Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works with co-hosts Lee Van Ham and Jerry Iverson. So much attention is given to people at the top and at the center, and yet most innovation and change comes from the bottom and the edges. That's what this podcast episode is about. Stay with us. Greetings, Lee, from Paso Robles, California, and Simple Living Works.
Greetings, Jerry, from me here in San Diego and Jubilee One Earth Economics. Well, today we have the chance to talk about courageous people in the really controversial arena of immigration. Immigration has come to affect more human lives today than at any time in the history of the world, and that startles me. But the World Health Organization keeps tabs on this, and to quote their website, more people are on the move now than ever before. There are an estimated 1 billion migrants, that's one-seventh of the world's population, 1 billion migrants in the world today, of whom 258 million are international migrants, and 763 million are internal migrants, 1 in 7 of the world's population. So that's an amazing amount of people on the move, and it's why we're dedicating this episode to immigration.
Thousands of people and organizations advocate for immigrants. Even so, the best advocates are the immigrants themselves. That gets to the heart of the conversation you'll hear shortly as Lee talks with our guest, Lane Van Ham. Lane points out that immigrants are archetypally the strangers in a strange land. Enormous creativity is being generated by these strangers today and throughout human history. It is the strangers in a strange land, far more than the privileged in the land, who envision the world that makes space for all of us, the only world that can save life on our planet today. Immigrant advocates change systems from the bottom up, from the margins outside of borders. They force rethinking of what border means and how it gets used politically, racially, and religiously. When we speak of immigrant advocates, we're talking about a lot of people, intelligent people, people who know how to live on very little of Earth's resources. Our own country can learn a lot from them, but we have to listen instead of exclude. Many immigrants have a spirituality that sustains them through the impossible. When we lock them up in torturous prisons and cages or send them back to the pain they are fleeing, these actions are to our own detriment, not our benefit. To treat immigrants as human is far more morally right. It is recognizing their gifts, seeing them as invaluable to our efforts to reverse climate change, correct injustices of white privilege, shape the creation-based economy that works for all, and taking care of one another amid the pandemic. They know the traumatic grief of leaving family, home, and country, fleeing under threats of joblessness to torture and death. Where in the world can they be seen for their true value?
Well, now let's get to the heart of this podcast episode, Jerry. It's a conversation I had recently with Lane Van Ham. Well, let's call it a family conversation. To be clear, it's the son, not the dad, who is the expert on immigration advocacy. In other words, it's Lane and not me. The show notes to this episode provide a link to Lane's resume. He currently teaches in the writing program and the applied humanities program at the University of Arizona, where he also earned his PhD. He's written 2 books on the topic of immigration, the topic we're discussing with him, plus many articles in professional journals. So let's go now to our previously recorded conversation. Well, I'm looking forward to having this, I'll just call it a family conversation with Lane. And over the years, I've just learned a whole lot from you, Lane, about immigrant advocacy. And now with the book that you put together for last year, it's just a great opportunity for us to talk again on this new podcast episode. And of course,
the context of what's happening in the world with immigration and in our country makes it also a very good time to be talking about any aspect of immigration. And of course, lots of immigrant advocates right now are really frustrated. It's a difficult time for advocacy, I think. But anyway, let's just start here with a little bit of history from you. You've been working in this area of immigrant advocacy for a good while, many years. And I would just like you to take us through some of that, some of the learning that came to you, some of the writing, some of the action that you've taken in this area in years past. Take us through it.
Well, I mean, I think the short version is that in 1998, I moved to Tucson, Arizona to attend graduate school and became aware pretty soon after arriving that there were a lot of interesting things going on in Tucson regarding immigration because it was just an hour from the U.S.-Mexico border. And I had some prior familiarity with those issues because some of it just had to do with the early political consciousness I developed in the late 70s and the 1980s, where refugee issues were pretty prominent. And then in the 90s, in the mid-90s, I worked for a year and a half in a homeless shelter in Texas for immigrants. So I had some prior familiarity with those things that I kind of, that made me, I guess, especially attuned to those politics in Tucson. And then when it came time to write my dissertation in 2004, I decided to profile three local groups, three Tucson groups, mm-hmm. who were trying in various ways to critique the rise of border militarization and in some cases doing direct material aid, humanitarian assistance for undocumented people. And that led to my my dissertation and my first book, A Common Humanity, which was published in 2011. Mm-hmm. And then interests that arose writing that book led to the more recent one, Composite Nation.
Yeah, just, I think it'd be good if you named those, the organizations you actually did your field study with and work with in preparation for your dissertation. You referred to them, but I think it deserves to give them a shout out here as we talk.
Yeah, so the three organizations profiled in the book are the Coalición de Derechos Humanos and Humane Borders and the Samaritans.
Yeah, and they each had kind of a niche that they worked in, I think, even though they collaborated.
Or not.
yeah, or didn't.
Yeah, so I wouldn't want to overstate any of that, but I mean, certainly there were commonalities among them.
And if you were like Derechos Humanos, what was their niche?
Well, Derechos Humanos had a pretty heavy educational focus, community outreach focus, and conducted various workshops for mm-hmm. undocumented people, and had a hotline that people could call for information. A monthly community forum that they held on some sort of issue congruent with immigration concerns. They co-sponsored, actually were really the primary sponsors of a weekly vigil that was held for migrant deaths. So they did a variety of work.
Yeah. And then the Samaritan Project, is that what it was called?
No, just early they were called Samaritan Patrol, and then they just became Samaritans. Samaritans were involved in, and are still involved in, just taking food, water, and first aid equipment out into the desert and walking through areas that were known to be crisscrossed by migrants and looking for people, basically just calling out, looking for people who might be in need of assistance.
Mm-hmm. And I remember actually going out with on a trip, and we actually came across some immigrants, which was really, I was riding with John Fife. And I guess that was because I was in Tucson for a continuing education, continuing learning event. And so John Fife took us back into an area, and you know, it was just, John Fife says, this never happens. There are actually some immigrants there. And I let them use my cell phone to make a contact in Tucson, and just made sure that they had what they needed, and we came back in. But I think you did a number of those kinds of runs yourself, didn't you, where you went out and into the desert, or am I wrong?
Yeah. That was largely what the, I mean, the field work consisted really of going to events, going to their meetings, and you know, just kind of doing whatever members of the organization did. So, I mean, I don't know how many times I went out, maybe somewhere between half a dozen and 10.
Yeah. And you start your book, A Common Humanity, with a incredibly moving story of going to the desert and being part of a ritual commemorating the life of someone who had lost their life.
Right.
There. And I mentioned the name John Fife in case I should elaborate for listeners. He for many years was pastor of Southside Presbyterian Church and very active in immigrant issues, including the sanctuary movement. And he was charged. Was he ever in prison?
No. I think all of the people who were, I mean, that's not something that I've read about in quite some time, but all the defendants in the sanctuary trial who were found guilty, I think had to pay fines and were given probation.
You know, well, if any of you
can look that up if they're interested in knowing what the outcome of the trial was, but no, John didn't go to prison.
Yeah, I've been just thinking, Lane, that if any people listening to us, you know, go to Tucson and they aren't familiar with some of the work that's going on there, certainly a visit to Southside Church, I suppose at most any time, but would be one way to get introduced to some of the immigrant activity, because they've been, I think they've evolved over the years in various ways to continue to meet needs of immigrants. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, Southside remains very much part of that kind of extended community.
Yeah. And the third group that you did your field work with, I already forgot their name. It was
Humane Borders.
Humane Borders, there you go. What was their emphasis?
So the idea with Humane Borders was to create water stations, permanent fixed water stations out in the desert that could be accessed for water. Mm-hmm. And so a trip I took with Samaritans would consist pretty much just of going to the church where they were headquartered at the time and heading out in a truck that was just full of, just had a bunch of water on it. And you go out to whatever station was that had to be refilled and check the water levels. And if it had to be refilled, you'd refill it. If it didn't, then leave. And that was that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Humane Borders actually was headquartered also at Southside Church?
No, they were at a different church. They were at a Disciples of Christ church. They were different church.
Yeah, so different denominations of churches were involved, and I guess still are involved to some degree, more or less, in the continuing realities regarding immigration in Tucson. Well, just for listeners, we'll move on from this, but this is all part of Lane's book, which first it became, there was a dissertation, but then Then it became a book also, A Common Humanity. And his subtitle is Ritual, Religion, and Immigrant Advocacy in Tucson, Arizona. So that one's very much focused in that particular part. But I think it's accurate to say that a lot of what's most particular around immigrant advocacy is also quite universal. I don't know if that seems right to you, but I know that when I've talked with people from other areas, and I learn what they're doing around immigrant advocacy. One woman in particular comes to mind who was working with immigrants in Italy as they were coming across the Mediterranean from Africa. And her work, you know, I mean, it was like talking to you in many ways about what I'd learned from Tucson. But that book focused in Tucson is really quite different from your new book, Composite Nation, A History of Immigrant Advocacy in the United States. So your second book is broader in that it refers to all that's gone on in the U.S. And you give us an overview of immigrant advocacy across U.S. history. So what moved you to write this second book?
So it's kind of a long story. When I was working on the dissertation, the origin of the book really goes back to the dissertation. A couple things came up really quickly in the course of writing the dissertation. And one was that because the three groups I was working with were doing slightly different things, it was really difficult to come up with a term that was capable of covering all three.
Uh-huh.
And I needed to come up with a term for that breadth of activity, and nothing that existed that I was aware of really seemed inclusive enough of doing that, because it was kind of about immigrant rights, but kind of about more than that. I mean, it was kind of about humanitarian aid, but it was kind of about more than that. And so I decided to use the term immigrant advocacy, which I later determined had been used by at least one other person before. And I mean, must have been sort of circulating, but not very widely. And this was kind of part and parcel of the second problem that came up, which was that, you know, like any good researcher, I wanted to provide background on the organizations I was working with and the stuff they had done. But of course, I couldn't use immigrant advocacy as a search term because it wasn't being used.
Hmm.
That just hadn't entered kind of the popular discourse. And so I couldn't just search for immigrant advocacy and find a bunch of resources.
Ah, yeah.
I had to piece this together. And so by virtue of talking with the long time, you know, the real veterans, the people who had been doing this kind of stuff since the 70s or in some cases before, I would take what they told me about being kind of their point of entry into these issues and then trace that back to something else. And pretty quickly I figured out, first of all, that once I was working with this concept of immigrant advocacy, there was really a very long story there that hadn't been told, that there were a lot of things that really fit under that rubric but hadn't been identified as such. And I also figured out that it was way too much for me to write about in the dissertation. So once I was done with the dissertation and once Common Humanity came out, I continued to read about this stuff. And although there were a lot of really interesting books about specific eras or specific immigrant groups, what I wanted to do was really take that material and stitch it together into a single narrative that would demonstrate that there's this lineage, this consistent lineage of thought and action in U.S. history that demonstrates that the work people are doing today has precedents that go back to the 19th century and maybe beyond. So that was kind of the basis of writing the book.
So it's interesting that you came to the term immigrant advocacy, but you couldn't research under that title, that you had to think of kind of affiliate phrases or words. to use. Well, I think at the back of the book is where you refer to some of these resources that you were using all along, probably in your dissertation research and maybe in coming together the first book. I would think that that's an invaluable chapter. You really write it kind of it's not an annotated bibliography. It's not a straight bibliography. It's kind of a chapter in its own where you review the some suggested readings. I would think that'd be incredibly valuable to an academic, as you suggest, further reading. I was just blown away when I read through that section, partly because I thought, golly, this guy has looked at so many sources and, has so much sense, such a sense of the breadth of work that's going on in immigration. And of course, I think that lends lots of credibility to your book, Lane, because, to write a history of immigrant advocacy in the U.S. We'll call it a mini book in 100 pages is quite a feat. And one could quickly say, well, it's got to be, it can't be very comprehensive, really. And of course, okay, granted, it can't be. But at the same time, what that last chapter revealed to me is, oh, but there's such an extensive knowledge of the field that I can trust that this is indeed a pretty good picture of immigrant advocacy's history in the U.S. So that's sharing how that chapter impacted me. I would imagine that it's your hope that professors who teach about immigration will want to find this book. I know that when I put it in the hands of a professor, she immediately recognized, like in 1 minute's time, like, oh, this could be really useful to me, because students don't want to read five volumes on some of these things, and I don't know how to always pick just the small piece. So she thought it might be really useful, although I don't know if she's committed to using it in her class or not, which I'd like to find out. But I just want to know, are you especially thinking about those kinds of classes, or do you have other people in mind who you think might be really helpful for reading this book?
I don't actually know that the book would be, it's great to hear that somebody was interested. I don't expect that many academics will be interested in the book, honestly. It's really not a scholarly book per se. Just in all kinds of ways. I originally thought that kind of set out to do that. Years ago, that was what I wanted to do, but there were a few problems with doing it that way because, I'm not a historian and I'm not trained as a historian. And I also just realized after a while that to write a book like that, the way that I wanted to do it, the task was just so enormous. I kind of wondered if I was ever going to finish. And so I was actually kind of stuck on that for a few years. I didn't really do anything with it because I couldn't figure out a way forward. But I have this, punk rock background that kind of says, well, you don't need to be a great guitarist to write 7.5 minute guitar solos, to do a great song. You can write a song that's 2 minutes with two chords, and if it comes from the right place, it can have an impact. So I kind of decided to write the punk rock book. So it's really small, right? Your palm covers it up. It's a really small book. It's also a really short book. It's only 10,000 words. And just thinking about who I wanted to reach with it. I don't know if it would be taken seriously, quote unquote, by scholars, but I do hope that it's of interest to people who are actually immigrant advocates, to people who are involved in immigrant advocacy work, because I think this might be sort of a weird word to use, but I actually think it's kind of fun for us to perceive ourselves as an outgrowth of history and to perceive precedence for the kind of work that we do. And in the case of immigrant advocacy, I think it's really worth knowing that a lot of the things that we like and take for granted about immigration in the United States are actually relatively recent developments. They weren't always there, that they may only be 50 or 60 or 70 years old, that they represent victories that were hard fought, hard won, and recognizing that the kind of, it's at some point, all of these things that we take for granted were at one point maybe deemed politically unrealistic, and they existed really only as, you know, kind of starry-eyed ideals. And I think it's a good thing for contemporary immigrant advocates to know that and to be familiar with that heritage and claim it, because I think we're really going to need it in the years ahead, in the years and the decades ahead. I think it's going to be really important that we continue to cultivate this kind of ethos of helping the displaced. And I mean, for better or worse, one way that we legitimize ideas is by demonstrating their vulnerability. And I think that showing that immigrant advocacy is not some kind of recent manifestation, but really a longstanding tradition, is a step in that direction. At the same time, if people want to do something scholarly with it, that's great. But I think really, as I wrote it, I was hoping it would kind of end up in the hands of people who are, you know, doing the citizenship fairs and volunteering to help people translate, and out there with the signs, walking on the sidewalk. That's the readership.
I think that's helpful information for anyone listening, Lane, because who knows how many people, not only among the listeners, but as listeners hear you say that, they think, oh, this could be good for Bill, this could be good for Rachel, this could be, and so on. So, I think it's certainly, from my reading the book a couple of times, it certainly succeeds in that, because one, it's like, oh my gosh, no kidding, this goes back this far, you know? And yet on the other hand, like you say, there's also recent developments. And so to be an immigrant advocate, one could see, oh, I stand in quite a lineage here. And yet at the same time, there's innovation. And, I just want to say a little bit more, or have you say a little bit more, frankly, about this phrase, immigrant advocacy. You've said a good bit already, but, I didn't think of that word really until I read your first book. And it was in your first book that I began to value that phrase for its, maybe I would say, its uniqueness and for kind of the freight that phrase carries. And certainly in your first book, one of the things that impressed me in A Common Humanity in that book was how both the migrants but also the immigrant advocates were continually developing a language that could work for crossing borders, and the incredible ingenuity and creativity that goes into how you legitimate crossing a border when the nation state enforcing its borders often you're often in disobedience to those norms. And so how do you legitimate it? Because it's not that the immigrant advocates are trying to be terrible citizens, they're trying, in fact, to be good citizens. And so I just appreciated how this was being developed in a common humanity. And some people used religious language, some people used more kind of universal language, cultural language. But it was the language, perhaps, of immigrant advocacy that was striking me. Now, I've been rambling about it a little bit, but perhaps it means going back to your first book, but you show a high regard for people who advocate for immigrants, and you said something about how you come about it, but maybe you can just comment on what I just rambled through about how this phrase works with borders and nation states' enforcement of borders.
Well, yeah, I'll see what I can do. I mean, one thing I want to mention, although just to make it clear, is that the term immigrant advocates includes the immigrants themselves.
Okay.
It's not just people external to that. I mean, immigrants have always tended to be their own advocates, first and foremost. They advocate for themselves before anybody else does. Mm-hmm. And they don't always have access to the levers of power in the same way, and they don't always circulate in the kind of the they don't have the connections to the prestige and the social capital that other people have, but they recognize what their own needs are and their own interests and try to organize around them as they're able. So there's always this is always both about immigrant advocates who are themselves immigrants and immigrant advocates who are not. And maybe in that combination, there's something. I mean, in the abstract sense, there's the idea of the immigrant as kind of the archetypal stranger in a strange land, right? The alien to the society who's vulnerable in ways that other people are not. And I guess that summons up a certain degree of admiration, but. From the perspective of the person who isn't really impacted by it, it summons a certain sense of compassion. Mm-hmm. And with regard to the specific context that I'm looking at in the United States, it seems to me that people who are involved, when I start reading about this stuff, when I would get into congressional testimony, get into speeches and pamphlets that people have written, immigrant advocates, it doesn't take very long before they're telling a kind of a story about the United States that is really, really potent. And I guess what I find interesting is that no matter what era I'm looking at, immigrant advocates are always telling a story that's a little bit bigger than what a lot of people want to tell or what a lot of people want to hear. So, you go back to the Irish in the mid-19th century, and a lot of people are saying, well, the Irish are never going to really belong. They don't really fit here. And the same has been said of every group that comes after them. And so by insisting somehow that the American story could encompass all of these newcomers, whoever they were, I've just found that immigrant advocates, whether they were immigrants or not, had this combination of faith and foresight that I just found kind of compelling, kind of admirable.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you just said, I find it very emotionally moving and very, very, very helpful. It's such a high view of the immigrant advocate to think of the immigrant as having archetypal status as the stranger in a strange land. Ooh, that has a lot of power for me anyway. I've often thought, I don't know that you ever say this in your first book, but this may just be sort of the riff I've done with it, but the things you say there about the nation state and how a nation state, it's not that nations have borders that are defined by God, or that they're defined, sometimes they're not even defined by geography or anything particular other than what you refer to in that book as political imagination. And so what was imagined one time, immigrants, and I love that you say that immigrants are their own advocates, that's powerful. That they have a different political imagination about what comprises a border and what the borders are in life and that shape their lives. And I've often thought of how quite some years ago, decades ago, governments came together, the nation states, many nation states who wanted to be able to move money around. Well, actually, the nation states didn't do this so much as transnational corporations. They decided, hey, we got to be able to move money and we've got to be able to move our businesses, but we want the people to stay fixed so we know where our labor force is and that kind of thing. And so it just strikes me again that we live in the society where many of the things that the corporate world wants, they get to move around wherever, but that includes keeping immigrants kind of in place. I don't know, I mean, that means keeping people in place and not immigrating is the way I think I should say it. I don't know if you want to add anything to that or maybe even disagree with it, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it's just not really my area. So no. I wouldn't want to, I don't really feel confident talking about, I'm reluctant to come to any conclusions about what nation states as kind of a totality want or what corporations as a totality want. I don't know.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, let's move on to just the title of the book. So after reading it a couple of times, I came to know that composite nation, which intrigued me from the start, is something that Frederick Douglass said and that you quote in the book. I'm curious how you came to settle on that as your title. And then also, was Frederick Douglass an immigrant advocate?
So Composite Nation, the name of the book comes from a speech that Frederick Douglass gave. I'm not sure that he actually says Composite Nation at any point in the speech. He does say that he says the United States is the most, something like the United States is the most conspicuous example of composite nationality in the world. But the speech has come to be known as Composite Nation, the Composite Nation speech. And he delivered this speech in a number of cities in 1869, like 4 years after the Civil War. Huh. And one of the things that was going on in the United States at the time was an increased interest in an increased amount of attention given to immigration of the Chinese to basically to the West Coast, not exclusively, but mostly the West Coast. And they'd been coming since the time of the California Gold Rush and almost immediately faced an incredible amount of local, state and local persecution and discriminatory legislation, and it fought back against it very well. Great example of immigrants advocating for themselves. But they had also picked up support from some non-Chinese allies, including some former abolitionists. And the abolitionists remained active after the Civil War in many ways, and Frederick Douglass was one of them. So 4 years after the end of the Civil War, Frederick Douglass was traveling around giving this speech in which he identifies the United States as this example of what he calls composite nationality, the exceptionally high combination of people of different ethnicities and different religions here. And he says, well, what to do about the Chinese? And he takes a really strong position. He says the Chinese should be allowed to come. The Chinese should be allowed to naturalize and become citizens. They should be allowed to vote. They should be allowed to hold office. Really, really strong positions. And he goes further, really, and says, I mean, it's startling, really, reading it, thinking that this was 1869. He says, the white population of the world is pretty small. And he says the amount of immigration of non-white people to the United States is going to increase. the amount of immigration to the United States from non-Christian people is going to increase. And the United States is going to have to figure out what to do about that. And and he says, really, there's only one thing to do. He says, we have to welcome this diversity. We have to do that because it's in keeping with our claims to freedom and equality. And it's a fulfillment of national purpose. So I just adopted that as the title for the book because I quote his speech in the chapter that's primarily devoted to that era. And it's just meant to acknowledge kind of the prophetic flair of that speech because he brings together so many ideas that are articulated by other people and organizations throughout the book.
Well, great. And that little extra background on it makes it all the more useful. Well, I guess we're going to have to kind of gradually wind this down here, but I want to say a little bit more about this book, Composite Nation, which I hope many of our listeners will want to get. It's, I guess you just get it online. I don't know if bookstores are carrying it. I would imagine that online is the best way. But I just came with a new understanding of the uneven treatment of immigrants and immigration across U.S. history for you treat a couple hundred years, I think, at least in there. What are the main drivers as you look at that history for understanding what has made our country inclusive at times and then restrictive, even highly restrictive at other times? I think we'd have to say that at the moment we're highly restrictive. What have been the drivers for that?
Well, that is, I mean, it's really difficult to answer that question. And a lot of political scientists have tried and a lot of historians have tried. And the conventional wisdom is just to say that when the economy is strong and unemployment is low, that people tend to be more accommodating of immigration. And then when the economy tightens and there's a lot of competition for jobs, that people become less tolerant of immigration. But as soon as you do that, you have to point to specific eras and say, well, there's an exception for this, and there's this asterisk, there's this footnote. And so forming generalizations about that is really difficult. And then there are all these other things to take into account, that some immigrant groups are thought of more highly than others. And there are differences in the attitude that may prevail among the public, and the public often takes a very negative stance toward immigration. And although some politicians kind of pay lip service to that, typically politicians recognize that immigration serves all kinds of things that are in the national interest. And so there's a kind of a discrepancy there. There's a difference between, I mean, admitting immigrants to the country isn't the same thing as the treatment that immigrants are afforded once they're in the country. So it's difficult to generalize about those things. So I would say that what I'm interested in doing in the book is just to kind of say, just to point out, I guess, that regardless of whatever the political will has been or whatever the national mood has been, immigrant advocates have always done their work.
Wow, that's impressive, isn't it? And it really is. Well, this has been a lot of fun for me. I hope it seems like we've covered your book with some adequacy, and you've certainly shared a lot of information. Lane, do you have anything else you want to share?
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. It's been a treat. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee and Lane. Have you listened to our recent episodes? In April, we shared some of the most thought-provoking interpretations of the pandemic entitled Coronavirus, a devastating natural disaster with a message, live differently. In May, life with COVID-19, heading toward a more ecological world. In June, pandemic shows food systems broken, opens door to better choices. In July, as this world ends, the light at the end. In August, leaving superpower ways for Earth-sized living. Do listen. We're sure that you'll pick up thoughts that you'll value. We certainly did as we created those episodes. You can subscribe to this podcast under the name Simple Living Works at your favorite podcast service. Individual episodes are available at Jubilee's new website, oneearthjubilee.com, and also simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Urge your friends to do the same. We have some fascinating announcements to make. During Advent, that is the four-week period before Christmas, we urge you to read and use Lee's new book, The Liberating Birth of Jesus, a birth story able to reverse the earth's perils. Read and hear more about it at the links in this episode's show notes and at theoneearthproject.com/books. That's theoneearthproject.com/books. Order a copy directly from Jubilee or from various suppliers on the internet. Next, watch for news about an upcoming series of new short videos from Jubilee One Earth Economics. They'll be posted for free on YouTube. You can be a promoter of Jubilee Living. Watch for information about a new certification course. And finally, order a copy of Lane Van Ham's new book, Composite Nation, A History of Immigrant Advocacy in the United States, directly from One Earth Publishing, a service of Jubilee One Earth Economics. Please tell us your thoughts on these subjects. Leave a message on Jubilee One Earth Economics and Simple Living Works Facebook pages. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works with co-host Lee Van Ham of Jubilee One Earth Economics, wishing you well as we strive together to bring simpler One Earth living into being for the common good.